Welcome to this Wednesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, Prairie Beat sounds a warning from the trees. The emerald ash border has been confirmed in Fargo, and what does that discovery mean for North Dakota's landscapes, neighborhoods, and millions of ash trees? And later, a bigger picture look at American agriculture. Stephen Banks of the Farm Security Initiative has written a provocative white paper. We'll find out why he thinks it's time to treat farming as critical national infrastructure.
Welcome to another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. This is your host, Rick Eon, and we're dishing up some hot dish today. We'll have a lot of fun with this conversation. Justin Clark from Rosewild at the Jasper Hotel in downtown Fargo joins us to talk a little hot dish and a really good community initiative that helps pay for student meals and healthy snacks for low-income kids. Justin, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in the service industry.
Absolutely. I'm originally from New England, so Vermont, so small town Vermont. I've been in the hotel industry for 20 plus years, anywhere from the Caribbean all across the U.S., so Park City, Jackson Hole, Napa Valley, all over the place, and now since September of 24 in Fargo.
Now here in Fargo, North Dakota, and we're happy to have you. Tell us a little bit about Rosewild at the Jasper Hotel. It's a special place, a destination.
Absolutely. The hotel itself and Rosewild, a lot of people come just for the hotel and the restaurant. It's good for locals, people coming in, upscale, but very approachable. Rosewild itself, you can go to the lounge and have a burger. You can go and have a ribeye in the dining room. So best of all worlds, great wine list, great beverage list. So good place to go. Nice and welcoming in Fargo.
And I love that burger and the Sidewinder fries. And we'll talk a little bit about what makes that burger even more special a little later on in the segment here. Now, for the third year in a row, I was a judge, honored to be a judge at the, I think, 9th Fargo Hot Dish Festival at Brewhalla, put on by the fine folks at Drecker Brewing Company. And that's always just a really, really fun event. A lot of things going on there. Hundreds of tickets sold. It sells out in like 3 days. It's really a popular event around here. So 14 competitors this year, Justin, you were one of them. And you won some major awards, including Grand Champion and People's Choice. I have to stay neutral. I'm friends with a lot of people in the restaurant business around here, but I tell people, you know, I have to stay neutral, but they're always bugging me to vote for them or whatever. But anyway, People's Choice and Grand Champion.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. And first of all, the event, it's an incredible event. Drecker puts on a great event. Brewhalla does. You have 14 different restaurants doing all kinds of different hot dishes, their interpretations from very traditional to way out of the box, which is great because you come and it's not just 14 of the same hot dish again and again. So it's incredible to go to. It was fun. Last year was my first one. We got People's Choice and Most Creative last year. So it was good to get the People's Choice again. That means a lot to us, the people coming there enjoy it. But it's just a fun time. All the restaurants have fun. It's a competition, but it's also just getting together, doing some fun things in the community.
Yeah, it's a friendly competition, that's for sure. Well, talk a little bit about this winning hot dish. It was really good. I voted for it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so this year, it kind of gets started with what we have on Wednesday. We have a bullet bourbon dinner, four-course dinner on Wednesday. So we took that bourbon approach into it. So bourbon braised short rib, with mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes, peas, parsnips, brown butter, carrot puree, and then pistachio crumble on top. So hearty, a little off traditional, but a lot of the same stuff that you used to, the root vegetables, the potatoes, the meat. It was a great thing our culinary team put together. It was great. I loved it. And it is going to end up on our menu. So if you couldn't make it out, probably the end of this week, beginning of next week, we're getting it in, making it so it's actual a plate you can order. So we'll have it for the whole month of February. So if you weren't able to make it out to the Hot Dish Festival, you can still come and try the Grand Champion and People's Choice.
Will it be served in the award dish you got? That photo will be posted on our Facebook page, but this it's like a giant hot dish, and it's heavy. And I'm guessing you'll be displaying that with some pride.
We will, yep. And we'll put the People's Choice next to last year's as well and put it out there. But yeah, it's a great dish. It goes right with the Hot Dish Festival. It's what you want to make your hot dish in and serve it. We will not be using it for that. We will put it on plates here and in our dishes. But yeah, it's a great event, a lot of fun. Great seeing everyone out there too. 650 plus people coming out to it. And it's amazing. I mean, we ran out about an hour earlier for our hot dish this year with the same amount of hot dishes last year. So it goes quickly. They come in and they go to town for sure.
And you all have to make 6 or 7 full hotel pans of hot dish for this event.
7 full hotel pans, yep. So that's a lot. And for this one, in 17 minutes, we were done with 2 full pans.
Wow, that's like for folks that aren't in the industry, that's like dozens of pounds of hot dish.
Yep. And 3 ounces at a time given out, absolutely.
Well, with these awards and accolades comes a discussion about the head chef, the kitchen staff, the wait staff, just everything over there. Talk a little bit about your kitchen staff.
Absolutely. Incredible team. We've had people in there that have been there for a long time. But they're excited about doing these events. Usually in a restaurant, you have the same menu for a few months straight. They're cooking the same things again and again. So when it comes to these events or special dinners that we're putting on, it's fun. They go... they tried so many different things till they came to this final dish, testing it out, having fun with it. They're very creative. They're great cooks, great chefs. Our front of house team's phenomenal. So it'll be great for them to sell it as well there. We made 8 pans. The other one came for the family meal, her employee meal that day. So they got to enjoy it that day as well. But yeah, phenomenal team, very creative. And we have a different chef this year than we did last year. But it's the team that's in there. It's not always just the leadership that does it. It's the team that's in there every day working hard, having fun with a new thing and to try stuff out. And that's why it's important for us to get our special chef's tables coming back this summer of you do something different. People can come in and dine and don't have to go off the menu. It can be something that is planned ahead of time and for the people and thought of the whole menu separately, which is great. I mean, that's what they want to do. They want to be creative. They don't want to do the same thing every day. So it's a great thing.
And I think with folks with special diets, gluten-free, vegetarian, vegan, that's really important.
Absolutely. Yep. And that's the one thing, just about everything on our menu can be changed up, especially nowadays. The gluten-free, vegetarian, vegan, the numbers are greater than they've ever been. So it's very important for us as not only a company, but as a kitchen, as a culinary department, to ensure that any guest that comes in will have as good of experience as a person that doesn't have any of the restrictions.
Well, you've had a history of winning at the Fargo Hot Dish Festival. I think last year was a braised pork cheek, which had some similar root vegetable medley to it. But there's a long history there of awards.
Yeah, two straight years of that. 3 years ago, we were not involved. And obviously before my time, but 4 years ago, there were winners as well. So Chef Austin, who is now our corporate executive chef out of our corporate office, was the opening chef at Rose Wild, and he was a winner at the beginning as well. So, yeah, 3 out of 4 years for us getting an award, which is phenomenal.
It is phenomenal. And talk a little bit about the upcoming bourbon dinner tonight.
We're having it tonight, 7 p.m. Is the seatings that are left. We have Bobby Burke from Bullet coming from Kentucky. We have not only single barrel, which is fairly rare that you get to try, but also a new Bullet bourbon that is not out yet, a mesquite, so it'll be a first taste, But it's a four-course meal. Chef and our culinary team put the same amount of effort into figuring out this four-course. Everything is made with one of their bourbons along the way, and then there will be pairings, mixed drinks for most of them, and then the last one will be the mesquite neat so they can try it. But yeah, it'll be a great dinner, from pork tenderloin to burnt ends to a s'mores pot for dessert with the chocolate has the bourbon in it. So great components that are gonna be there, which is, and it'll be fun. You know, we last year we did Molly Ye. We did Chef Jay Ducati, who is one of the judges for last year's Hot Dish Festival. We had special dinner, so this will be our first one this year, and we're looking forward to having a great night.
And we've interviewed Molly Ye, and we had Chef Ducati in here in the studio, so that was a lot of fun. When we bring you these chefs that are doing things around the region that are from here and outside of the region, Jay is specializes in Louisiana cooking.
Well, and it's also fun because the same thing. We have our Midwest food that everyone loves here, but it's great to bring people in and do something completely different. You know, completely different from our Rosewild menu, fully. You know, he came up with everything from Louisiana, Cajun-style food, and it's a great night out to enjoy this food that you don't always get to try, and especially coming from an expert like that, who that's what he does for a living, that's what he's great at. So we'll have more of those coming this year as well, which will be fun.
Yeah, Jay's catfish dish was really good. That I can attest to that. Well, switching gears here, you have a program or an initiative called Eat Local, Give Local that's seen a lot of success lately. Discuss that a little bit.
Absolutely. We started in August of 25, so August of last year, and tried to figure out a way to give back. We'd always done, you know, providing free stays or dinners for all these different charities, but what could we do ourselves at the property level? And our burger is the most popular item on our menu. So that's where we started of what can we do with our most popular item where some of the money goes back somewhere. We brought it up in an executive meeting of what do we want to do? Kids were the number one. Our first thought was, do we do, you know, back to school? It's August. Do we do backpacks, school supplies? Then we went, you know what, we want to go a little deeper than that. And it went to food insecurity in our schools in the Fargo area. And how can we help with that? So we did that. We started with just a burger at the beginning, $4 for every burger. We'll go to the school. It was Eagles Elementary who did for the school in the fall semester. And then it was going so well that we said, well, you can't get burgers in the morning on our breakfast menu, so let's add the breakfast sandwich too. So no matter what time of day, you can choose a meal that will go back to the kids. So we had a phenomenal fall semester. Ended up being around $6,800 given to Eagles Elementary to cover paying off school lunches to healthy snacks during the day to Friday care packages going home for kids that needed it, which was phenomenal. And when I talked to them at the end of the school year going into January, coming back from Christmas break, it was, how are you guys doing? Are we going to keep going with this? And they said, we're good. We have enough money. We're going to cover the semester. Why don't you try another school? So talked around in the community. Roosevelt is the one horse man. Roosevelt Elementary School is what we decided on. And just last week dropped off the first check for them, which was phenomenal to do. And the team loves it. Giving back to community, which I think, you know, especially a community like Fargo, where how I always say it, I've lived in New York City. I've lived in Boston, San Francisco. You stop, break down the side of the road, is someone going to pick you up? Is how I always do it. Being from Vermont, everyone will. And I feel the same here, that if I broke down on the side of the road, someone's stopping to help me. It's just that community. So I think it's very important as a business within the community to give back to the local community. And for us, we make food for a living, so we felt that was a good synergy of, hey, let's provide food for the kids and make sure that they don't have to worry about food while they're at school trying to learn.
Tell us a little bit about personal experience about handing over a charitable gift to a school.
It's emotional. I will say that.
Yeah, I bet.
It's you know, when we just came last week, you see the happiness of that kids, because obviously these people choose the industry as a principal or a teacher because they want to help kids, and I know it hurts them. You know, during a school year when you can see kids struggling and not having food to eat, not having the money to pay for food to eat. So heading it off and seeing that emotion and that thankfulness and the thought of it's helping the kids, but it's also helping the families in the community. It helps teachers teaching and with kids that aren't hungry and not worried about that. They're able to really concentrate more on the school side of it. So it's incredible. It's emotional. Tears are definitely going down your cheek as they're talking about what they can do with it. So it's exciting. It's fun. And it's something that we're proud of. And we want to give back to the community. They're the reason we have a hotel and a restaurant is the community supports us. So we need to support the community back.
And I was one of those kids that had to skip the snack during the day and discounted school meals. So this conversation is very special to me. And just thank you for being a part of the community. That's really great.
Absolutely. And, you know, I grew up in a very small town in Vermont. And while I wasn't one of those kids, you know, we were small. Our seventh and eighth grade was 8 kids. And you knew the kids that didn't have money because they didn't bring lunches with them or they couldn't afford it. But in a small community back then, it was my mom would put a little extra in my school bag to ensure that, hey, hand this out, make sure everyone has food. And I think that's important for a community, just being there for each other.
Well, I do, before we go, I do want to talk about this burger because it's a double patty. It's very good. And I've had the breakfast sandwich as well. but talk a little bit about the burger, Sidewinder fries.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, it's my go-to as well. Brioche bun, you got the onions on there, the smash burger with cheese. It's incredible. The fries, too. People don't usually talk about fries. I love our fries. Nice and crispy, Sidewinder. A little different for me. It's I'm coming up. My last property, and I've been there for a while, was in Utah. So they have what's called fry sauce there. So that's the one thing here is it's not up here in Fargo. So you have to mix the mayonnaise and ketchup and mustard together and make sure you have the fry sauce for it or just ketchup. But yeah, it's an incredible meal. People love it. It's fun to make. And the good part of it, too, is we do have the vegetarian side of it. And even if you choose the vegetarian side, it's still going. It's the burger, and it'll still go to it if you want to go the vegetarian side as well.
Playing with your food can be worthwhile.
Absolutely.
Well, Justin, is there anything else you'd like to add about this program or your victory or Rose Wild or the Jasper Hotel?
Yeah, the one thing to add with the Eat Local, Give Local is that really was heartwarming to our team is we've had people come in and say, you know what, I don't want the burger, I want something else, but here's a check, please put it towards that. And you have community coming in and doing that, which was not expected. You know, we're just trying to get a little bit of money to pay for school lunches. And, you know, I think we probably did double the amount of money we thought we were going to do, which is great, and to be able to do multiple schools. But it's just a testament to the community of people coming and going, I've seen that. I want to give to it, but I don't want the burger today. Here's a check, which is phenomenal.
Justin Clark with Rose Wild at the Jasper Hotel. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you very much, Rick. I appreciate it.
I'm Rick Guillen, your host of Prairie Plates. We'll talk to you next week.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Jeanette Didios is Jicarilla Apache and Diné and reports for KUNM Radio in Albuquerque. Our Living Lands producer, Daniel Spalding, spoke to Didios about issues facing indigenous communities in New Mexico.
You've been reporting on the New Mexico State Legislature session. What are some of the issues you're seeing there that are most relevant to indigenous communities?
Yeah, sure, of course. Our legislature here in New Mexico just started on Tuesday. And I think just jumping in, there has been a lot of, you know, reactions from New Mexicans about, you know, rallies and protests. And there was a protest on Tuesday. And I think the biggest thing was just everyone speaking their voice. I mean, it wasn't just one central issue, but when I went to talk to folks, especially Indigenous folks on that day, a lot of people were concerned about land rights, water rights, as well as ICE, you know, that Minneapolis issue that happened. It's been seen and heard across the country, and even in New Mexico, there's folks that are worried and concerned of whether Native Americans are safe. You know, it's kind of ridiculous to think that, you know, there would be an issue with us, but there is. You know, Native Americans are being prosecuted, they're being detained, they're being deported, and, you know, a lot of Native Americans don't feel safe. You know, even if they have the proper identifications, birth certificates, ICE are turning around and saying that it's not real and that it's not official. So what more can we do, you know?
New Mexico is home to many different tribal nations and people, as well as, you know, a varied landscape and weather. How do you approach covering such diversity in environment and people?
I think when it comes to environment and people, it's really, first off, just to research as much as you can so that you understand the landscape of where people are and both sides of the table. I mean, a lot of what we're covering right now is in regards to Chaco Canyon. And there's both sides to whether or not they should decrease the borderline for oil and gas or widen it to protect the cultural landscape of it. And it's interesting because there's Native American folks on both sides of the table, some that want to continue oil and gassing because it's their land and it's their right to do whatever they want. And on the other side, there's other Native Americans that want to protect the cultural aspect of it. And, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know, say who's right and who's wrong. And to be able to cover and report on that, I think it's important to understand where they're both coming from and make sure that you accurately report on it and get both sides of the table so that those that are listening, your readers and folks get understand the full scale of it.
And you're from New Mexico. Can you share why you wanted to become a journalist and report on these topics in your home state?
And I think I wouldn't continue being a journalist if I couldn't cover Indigenous issues, because that's really the heart of it for me. Like, seeing the impact that I can do to help other Indigenous folks really shine a light on some of the issues that's been going on, I think that's what really does it for me. Like, it really, you know, it continues my fuel to continue reporting. I mean, for example, I think about 2 years ago, the Mescalero Apaches, they had a fire around their reservation. And I drove down there to report on it, even though it's about 2-3 hours from Albuquerque. And I was a little uncertain about going down there because, you know, they're just, you know, are recovering from fires. You know, some people may not want to talk to me. I totally understood that. And there wasn't a lot of reporting in the local news. So I was one of the only people that was specifically covering the Mescalero Apaches. And when I went down there, you know, they were so generous with their time and willing to talk to me and tell me what's been happening. And, you know, I really took that as a really kinship moment, because they were willing to help me, ask me if I needed anything, water and food, when in reality, you know, I wanted to be that for them. You know, so we were both trying to help each other. And I really thought that was a really special moment.
And my final question, last but not least, but I have to ask this one. Are you a red or green? Green chili. Which color, which chili are you?
I would like to say Christmas, because that would be a great answer, but I am a little biased and I love green chili more than red. I love my green chili chicken enchiladas. That's what I like.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Still to come on Main Street, Prairie Beat and the warning about ash trees, plus a provocative white paper about agriculture. Stay with us.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents A Night at the Oscars, February 21st at the Fargo Theater. Conducted by Jane Lind Capistran, the program features the FM choral artist with music from Oscar-winning films. Information at fmsymphony.org.
So, full disclosure, I don't know why this subject fascinates me so much. I've worked at Prairie Public since 2006. And I've basically been reporting on this bug the whole time, like my whole career. I'm like, oh God, it's getting closer and closer.
Hey, I'm Eric Deatherage.
And I'm Danielle Webster. It's another episode of Prairie Beat.
It's our weekly snapshot, Prairie Beat is, of news from the Prairie Public Newsroom. Danielle, I can kind of guess, but what is on the beat this week?
So I'm afraid you're going to have to indulge me a little bit this week, Eric, because I know there's a lot of things happening in the news. There always are. But this week, I'm going to have to geek out a little bit about bugs.
Bugs? Aren't all the bugs hibernating right now? Do they migrate? I mean, either way, it's too cold for this stuff right now, Danielle.
I know, I'm sorry. But this will be a pretty big story in North Dakota. So the specific bug we're going to talk about is an invasive pest called the emerald ash borer. And years ago now, when I first got this job, I started doing stories on this thing. It's a bright green little Asian beetle that's been moving around the country for years and just decimating the ash tree populations in several states. And if you'll recall, just last week, it was confirmed to have arrived in Fargo. The very first confirmed emerald ash borer was actually found just outside of Jamestown in North Dakota as well back in 2024. And the arrival of this beetle to the state is pretty significant because we don't have a ton of trees here. We're kind of known for our wide open spaces, a lot of farmland and stuff like that. But the trees that we do have, a lot of them, about 90 million to be exact, are ash trees. And since the emerald ash borer, or EAB, is deadly to these trees, that leaves a huge portion of our tree population vulnerable.
Okay, yeah, so you guys on the news team at Prairie Public have been following this for quite a while, quite a long time. And again, just recently with it being confirmed in Fargo, you actually did a story with the city forester who talked about how they've been preparing for this for years.
Yes, precisely. So this week, I wanted to zoom out from Fargo a little bit.
Tom Clays, North Dakota Forest Service State Forester.
Now, Tom Clays says the EAB was first found in Michigan in the United States in the early 2000s. And the way it got there was it pretty much hitchhiked from Asia to the United States through shipping containers. And then the ash trees started dying because they didn't, you know, nobody actually knew that it got here. And since this is a non-native to North America insect, our plant species here are not really evolved to be able to resist or even coexist with these things. So the consequences have been pretty dire.
The adults lay eggs on the bark. The larvae form underneath the bark and they actually start to eat underneath the bark. They eat the xylem and phloem underneath the bark and they wind up girdling the tree. That doesn't happen in 1 year's time. There's usually a couple and up to 3 or 4 or 5 years worth of larvae that have been eating underneath the tree bark. As the population builds up, will eventually kill the tree.
Now, a bit ago, we mentioned how forestry industry leaders have been preparing for the arrival of this pest for the better part of 2 decades. What exactly does that look like?
Right. So ever since this news that the EAB was in North America came out, forestry people everywhere have been laying the groundwork and getting ready for its arrival because it really wasn't a matter of if, but when it showed up in their communities. And since its arrival, it has traveled to 37 states over the past 20 years. Tom Clay says this whole time they've been working on mitigation plans.
Fargo is a good example of that. They have an excellent one. They've been working to remove ash for a number of years and diversify. Many other communities across the state have been doing the same thing. So if you've got a city forestry department or somebody that takes care of street trees, they're already aware of the impacts. They already have been preparing for the most part. Landowners and homeowners are aware of EAB. I think most people have heard of it. Whether or not they've taken a proactive measure and removed or treated an ash tree, that remains to be seen.
Now, a significant neighborhood comes to my mind when I think about big trees in North Dakota. A lot of North Fargo, the oldest parts of the city, have a lot of older and well-established trees. It really sounds like this could be devastating to neighborhoods like that with those sprawling tree canopies. Now, how prevalent is the ash tree in Fargo specifically?
When this story first came out, I spoke with the Fargo City Forester, Scott Ludall, and he explained how the city here has really been aggressive with their diversification efforts. In the city of Fargo proper, I think over 40% of the trees that lined the boulevards in the neighborhood, that was the official, like, initial population there, whereas ash trees.
And so what they've done over the years is they've worked really hard to plant other varieties of trees along those areas, and they've reduced the ash population down to about 21%. But as Tom Clays just said, you know, what happens to trees on private property is up to the landowners and the homeowners. So it's really incumbent upon those folks to figure out what varieties of trees there are on their property and then talk with local experts on how they can diversify their own tree populations.
So it does sound like these communities could be at risk of all their trees dying, all of them?
So in short, yes and no. With a lot of issues, there's always good and bad news. So the bad news, obviously, is that once this pest is well established and in the trees, there isn't much you can do for those specific trees. But the good news is, like Clay said, they've had a 2-decade head start on this thing. So there are treatments that have been developed you can administer to trees preemptively or when the EAB is detected early. And they've been very prolific with setting the traps so they can find these bugs as early as possible. And another bit of good news is that these beetles are not very good at getting around on their own. They don't fly very far distances. And because a lot of our trees aren't interconnected, you know, like that sprawling like forest some states have, the beetles will have a hard time spreading that way. Clay says what's likely to happen is there will be an EAB detection and it'll happen kind of like in fits and starts around the state, but it won't be spreading like wildfire really fast.
The way they're transported from county to county or state to state is the transport of wood products. Very often firewood, things like that. They're underneath the bark. They can move at 75 or 80 miles an hour down an interstate or 50, 60 miles an hour down a state highway. So that's generally how they make those big jumps across the U.S. And now in 36, 37 states across the U.S., you watch their detection locations. And oftentimes it's along a transportation corridor, an interstate, or it follows railroad tracks. They are hitchhikers, and they can move at the speed that we do.
He also told me that the spread will likely be very slow. So back in the 1960s, Dutch elm disease started claiming American elm trees. There was actually a really big, awesome one in my front yard when I was growing up. And so when that started happening here in North Dakota, they started planting those ash trees everywhere because they grow really fast, they establish themselves really well, and they were trying to get ahead of the elm trees, you know, all dying. But there are still communities in North Dakota that have elm trees that are just starting to see that disease make those trees get sick and die. So that's taken many years to happen. And if you're within like 15, 20 miles of Fargo or the Jamestown area, you still have time. You have plenty of time to get a game plan together for your own property.
So if I'm a landowner or a homeowner, where do I start if I want to see how many ash trees are actually on my property?
Tom Clays told me about a website called the North Dakota Tip Tool. So if you just Google that, it'll come up and it'll show you 166 different communities that have been inventoried there. You can just pull up where you live and you can see how many ash trees there are in your community.
Oh, cool.
And it will actually show you as you zoom in the location of that community's trees resources. It'll tell you the species, the location on a map. It'll tell you the condition of the tree. And it is actually quite shocking in North Dakota how much green ash mostly are in communities. We had a community in southeastern North Dakota early on. It was 80% ash in that community.
Now for funsies, I looked up my hometown at Devil's Lake just to see how many ash trees are there. And it was about 4,500 or so ash trees there, about roughly 12,600 different sites.
And that is a pretty significant amount of ash trees in just one town. But yeah, I mean, it sounds like they have a pretty solid game plan there. Plant more varieties of different trees, diversification, the name of the game, check out treatment options, and burn local firewood for those summer campfires. Don't import them from other places like the West Coast or something, right? Because those beetles like to hitch a ride. Those bugs may be small, but they certainly have big implications for the state of North Dakota. So all of that is really good to know, and quite fascinating too when you think about it. But trees, I mean, you know, I think of my daughter and a book I would read to her every night, and one of the lines was, you know, a tree trunk is the perfect place for quiet thoughts to be thunk. So, you know, a lot of kids, the imagination goes wild sitting under a tree in the summer, and I hope that that kind of thing isn't lost.
Absolutely.
I'll be waiting for you underneath the wishing tree.
Okay, trees, 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 but there's lots of other stuff happening in the region. What other stories are making headlines this week?
There is no panic right now. We're not worried about it.
Governor Armstrong says despite looming budget issues in the next biennium, there are no plans for any allotments.
It definitely is a safety hazard.
The Public Service Commission is investigating a possible abandoned mine near Cartwright, North Dakota. And after 47 years, the Norsk Høstfest is ending. The 2025 festival was its last event. They've cited financial issues and declining attendance.
Yeah, 47 years, not a bad run. I went to my first one a few years ago, and I tried lutefisk for the first time.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad. You know, I was all into it, but then they had the lutefisk competition, and there was just way too much of that wafting in the air. I'm like, I don't know. But it's certainly a big part of North Dakota culture and will certainly be missed. Thank you for all that, Danielle.
You bet. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more news or check out our online newsroom at news.prairiepublic.org.
Hey, you, listener, thank you for joining us again this week for Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, capturing up to 300 million metric tons of CO2 annually.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and when we talk about agriculture in this country, conversation usually turns to weather, prices, or the challenges individual farmers face year to year, but our next guest argues that this framing misses the point entirely. Stephen Banks is the author of a new white paper from the Farm Security Initiative that he created, and it's titled America's Roots Run Through Its Farms. In it, he makes the case that American agriculture hasn't become fragile by accident. It's been shaped by decades of policy and market rules that prioritize efficiency over resilience and quietly transfer systemic risk onto farmers themselves. Banks argues that food production should be treated as a critical national infrastructure and that without structural change, consolidation and instability are not failures of farmers, but are becoming predictable outcomes of system design. Stephen Banks joins us today to unpack that argument and what it could mean for the future of American food security. Stephen, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you very much, Craig. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Stephen, your white paper opens with the strong claim the problem is not the farmer. Why is that such an important place to begin the conversation?
Farmers are easy. It's easy to blame farmers. I think that stepping back and looking at the structure of agriculture and saying, why do we see these recurring crises? is for me the more interesting and the more telling question. Farms today, as opposed to decades ago, are subject to price controls on both ends, both on the input side and on the output side, to multinational organizations that have the capital to withstand market shocks. And one of the things that's occurred, of course, is that these market shocks, and we can talk about soybeans, or we can talk about beef, or we can talk about whatever. Farmers become the insurers of the marketplace. So they become the economic buffers as agriculture, as markets come and go.
Stephen, you argue too that agriculture looks productive in stable times, but then fails catastrophically under stress. What does that tell us about how the system is designed?
The system is designed for throughput. Okay, so you've got your big multinational organizations that are well capitalized and set up to process whether crops or livestock to process those inputs as economic or products as economically as possible. Okay, so what that means is you end up with large organizations, whether it's on the input side or on the processing side, that are designed for efficiency and market capture. And so what happens is when there are economic shocks to the agriculture system, these organizations are capitalized in such a way that they can weather those shocks. And what they do is they transfer the burden of those shocks, they transfer the risk of those shocks, and risk is something we need to talk about. They transfer the risk of the market failures onto the farmer, okay, or onto the producer. The producer does not have the necessarily the capital to withstand those kinds of shocks to their to their system. The input organizations already sold their achieved their market goals in selling the inputs, which leaves the producer to absorb the economic shock of whatever the failure happens to be.
We want to get to solutions a little bit later in our conversation, but want to learn more about core ideas that farmers have become the involuntary insurers, right? If you're talking about this single point failure system, they, in a sense, are the involuntary insurers of systemic risk then. What kinds of risks are you talking about for farmers? And why can't they realistically manage them? Is it simply a capital problem with farmers?
Farmers are biologically constrained, okay? When a farmer puts in his, makes a decision and plants in the spring, he has no control. Oh, I mean, obviously he controls his crop and he can whatever, takes care of his plants or livestock, whatever. But he doesn't know, or she doesn't know, what's going to happen in September, October when they go to market. The volatility in that market when they go to sell, right, is something they have no control over. You're making these commitments in May that you have no control over the outcomes. I come from the construction industry, okay, and I've told you that. In construction, we very deliberately price and assign risk. There is no pricing and assigning of risk when farmers get to September, October, and there's no market. They can't control that. They can't control the market. If it costs them $11 to harvest a bushel of soybeans, and if it costs them $11 and the market's paying $10.50, it's like, okay, suck it up, buttercup. You've got good intention and failed systems.
Steve, you say that consolidation isn't the disease, but it's a symptom. How does risk transfer mechanically drive consolidation? Tell us the background of that, almost regardless of intent.
Okay, what happens is that farms that are subjected to market stress, without the capitalization to weather that stress, those farms fail. And when those farms fail, somebody buys them. And who buys them? Capital buys them. And so you get this ongoing consolidation in agriculture. You know, and really the white paper is more about structure, but farmland is being not simply bought by the next farmer, right? It's being bought by, you know, multinational corporations, asset managers, and all those kinds of people. So what's happening is land is being, well, it's certainly being removed from the family farm, locally operated farm. And so these, and then what happens is those become more examples of extractive industries. They're pulling money out of rural America and sending it to Wall Street, essentially.
Enjoying my conversation with Stephen Banks. He's the author of a new white paper from the Farm Security Initiative that he's created. The paper is titled America's Roots Run Through Its Farms. Just Google Farm Security Initiative and you'll find his website. And he makes the case that America's agriculture hasn't become fragile by accident. Rather, it's shaped by decades of policy and market rules that prioritize efficiency over resilience and quietly transfer systemic risk onto the farmers themselves. All right, we've set the stage. Stephen, offer us your solutions. What are you thinking about?
Here's what I think about. A little metaphor that I've been working on lately or thinking about lately is the fact that when you get on the interstate, the speed limit's 70 miles an hour. And when we get into a school zone, the speed limit is 15 miles an hour. Okay, and we do that for life safety issues. I think that we need to protect agriculture in the same way we protect banking, in the same way we protect school kids. We need to put guardrails in place that don't push risk, unassigned risk, and push it onto producers, because that's what's killing this industry, badly hurting it. And I think that food resilience, food security, national security, it's said over and over and over again, but food resilience requires diversity, okay? We can't have these. I mean, the homely analogy is if we look at our healthcare system, okay? And we look at the struggles that we have in providing affordable healthcare across this nation. And do we really want that sort of dynamic in our food system? And I think that's very dangerous. I think that we need to acknowledge that in making corn, making soybeans, making cows is not the same as making Nike shoes, okay? Nike shoes, 70 miles an hour down the freaking freeway. But Food service, let's take care of it. Let's protect it. I've spent years traveling rural America, okay? I'm a motorcycle guy. I travel alone. I spend a lot of time in rural America. There's a lot of poverty out there. I don't get it. I don't understand. I think it's wrong. I think we really need to look at agriculture as food security. We need to take it seriously. I don't think, Stephen Banks, I don't think we should be operating our food system in the same way we run our tennis shoe businesses.
Let me interject here. I think there might be some critics who are listening and say, okay, you want to return to a heavy-handed government involvement here in agriculture, that markets, even in perfect ones, are still better at sorting winners and losers than maybe public rules or guardrails, as you describe them, designed in Washington or elsewhere. How would you respond to those critics who might say, this all sounds like central planning dressed up as resilience?
You know, I'm not proposing that we tell farmers what to plant, when to plant, how to plant, what to grow, any of that. Let the market determine that. What I'm saying is that we need to stop assigning these to the farmer, to producers.
That's Steve Banks. He's the author of America's Roots Run Through Its Farms, and he's the founder of the Farm Security Initiative. His white paper is available for your reading, and it argues that stabilizing American agriculture isn't about better farmers or bigger safety nets, but about redesigning the rules that govern a system the nation depends on. And you can learn more about the Farm Security Initiative, as Steve said, and read the full white paper at farmsecurityinitiative.org. Steve, best wishes on your travels, and thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you very much, Craig.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 4th. In the early days of the 20th century, newspaper readers frequently skipped the main headlines and turned right to the back pages to catch up on local news in columns with names like Society News. These columns contained information that seemed so minor and mundane that we might wonder why newspapers bothered to take up the space with them. For example, on this date in 1921, the Washburn Leader printed a full page of local information, such as: John Vogel made a hurried trip to Bismarck, returning Sunday afternoon with his brother Frank. Mr. and Mrs. Clarence Sundstrom spent Sunday afternoon in the Adolf Larsen home. And Charles Esping returned Friday from Bismarck, where he went to consult with doctors. In other newspapers of the day, you learned that Miss Rose McGillivray entertained at her home. Mr. and Mrs. A.C. Nelson went to Fargo for a visit, and Mrs. William Watt spent several weeks in Bismarck with her husband. Newspapers emerged in early 17th century Europe, a period that saw massive social changes, including expanding international trade and the emergence of political parties. Newspapers teach us what people thought was important at a particular point in history, and what their friends and neighbors were doing was very important. The first newspapers focused primarily on national and international events like the economy, politics, and military confrontations. Newspaper editors soon discovered that readers were just as interested in, if not more so, local comings and goings. People were more likely to buy newspapers if national and international news was accompanied by entertainment and gossip. Between 1777 and 1783, a writer named James Boswell wrote what might be the first gossip column in the London Magazine. Today's newspapers are threatened by new forms of media. Readers can open a news site on their computer or phone at any time of the day and from any location. These sites are updated frequently, much faster than newspapers could possibly be. The print form of newspapers seems to be an endangered species, and many have put an electronic version on the internet. It seems that little has changed. On social media, you can learn where people ate dinner and which movies they went to. People share where they went on vacation and who they visited. The gossip column is alive and well, if in a somewhat different form. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that wraps up this Wednesday's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tomorrow on A Closer Look with the Monitor, oil waste to critical minerals, an energy transition. We look forward to seeing you again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.